Okay, 3, 2, 1. Ciao.
That works.
Can you put that in? See the waveform. That works.
Can you put that in at the start? 3, 2, 1. Ciao, and then the music kicks in.
Right, it's time for season 2, episode 19 of the Linux Voice podcast. Yeah.
Hello. It's good to see you all again.
Getting good at this now.
Yeah, no live audience this time.
Yeah.
Probably just as well, given that I've not got any trousers on.
Too much information.
So, I'm Andrew Gregory, and I'm wearing no trousers.
I'm Greg Morrison, I am fully dressed.
I'm Ben Everard, and I too am fully dressed.
I'm Mike Saunders, and I'm not wearing lederhosen, sadly.
Have you got a pair, Mike?
No, I don't yet. No, it's something missing in my conversion to becoming an authentic buyer.
I'd have thought when you start paying taxes, they send you them, as a welcome gift.
Oh, yes.
And in this fun-packed episode of the Linux Voice podcast, we've got news, we have discoveries, we have a voice of the masses. We have some nuance to vocalise, but not in that order. And there's a halfway reminder.
Probably in that order.
Yeah, if you like this podcast, why don't you consider buying a subscription to Linux Voice magazine at shop.linuxvoice.com. There are options including... there are two options, really. Paper and digital. But the digital has now has a beat of EPUB. So you can the text reflows nicely on e-readers and tablets and things.
Also, Mike's been able to move us away from PayPal, which is awesome.
Our store now features Stripe integration, which basically means you can pay directly with credit or debit cards without the money going through PayPal. We know a lot of people are not fans of PayPal for various reasons, so that's something we've got. We are looking at Bitcoin payments and possibly setting up direct debits as well. So listeners who are Linux Voice subscribers should be able to renew using a bigger variety of payment methods soon.
We've got lots of people asking for direct debit so that it spreads the payment over the year or 6 months or whatever.
Yep.
Excellent. That's good news, which brings us nicely into news.
I see what you did there.
News. The news. There's quite a lot of news this fortnight, actually. But first up is Google's decided to remove support for removable ext formatted file systems from Chrome OS. So you'll no longer be able to use the sort of native Linux file format on removable media in Linux because Google says it's not widely used. I can't speak for everyone. I actually don't use Linux file systems on removable media. I always use NTFS.
Yeah, FAT32 normally on my USB keys,
I never use FAT32 because too many times I've tried to copy a DVD ISO onto it and it's failed at the last minute and I've got furious.
So Since it became legal, you meant, Ben?
Yes. It's going to upset some people, but I guess this is the issue you have when a large commercial company is running a distro. It's fundamentally a Linux distro. They can make these decisions and they don't really have to listen to the community. Next up, Google has reversed its decision to remove ext formatted file system. Yeah, after announcing that they were going to remove them, the community got up in arms and furious and said, actually, a lot of people do use these file systems on removable drives, and why on earth are you removing them? The support is there. You're using the Linux kernel. You're just being petty by removing them.
I mean, that's what I was going to say. I mean, it can't really save any Chrome OS resources, really, can it?
No, I mean, either processor or person resources. No, it's something that's just there.
Yeah.
They get
so
for free
not?
By using... Yeah.
It's a lot easier for Chrome OS to do it than trying to get something similar working in OS X or on an iPad or whatever it happens to be. And if they can do it, then why not?
Yeah. I don't know if OS X's got any better, actually, but I used to have a nightmare that...
It still is a nightmare.
In so many ways, but it couldn't write to NTFS drives.
Yes, yes. It's the same, and it's all through Fuse. Yes, and you can kind of get EXT support in OS X by going through the same kind of Fuse setup, which has improved in the last 12 months or so, but it's just, you know, when I dual boot them both, you know, it's a real nightmare trying to get files across. I often put them on a NAS box or a USB stick.
I remember I used to try and use Google's Drive, actually, and that would sit there and it'd let you upload the full 4 gig of a DVD ISO. And then after everything would upload, it'd say, "We've detected this file type is not supported."
"We've detected the file is Wreck-It Ralph and you do not have the rights to upload it."
So anyway, those two news stories culminate in the fact that nothing's changing.
You heard it here first, listeners. Yeah.
Next up, Tor, the Tor project, the anonymizing router, have released version 4 of their Tor browser bundle. This comes with the sort of usual security updates, etc., etc. But the really interesting thing for me is it's got the, what they call the Meek pluggable transport. And the pluggable transports were introduced a couple of versions ago, I forget exactly when. And the idea is they become much better at hiding Tor traffic in legitimate web traffic. So this is particularly important for people living in countries where the government, for whatever reason, have decided they want to block Tor. The idea of pluggable transports is to make that much harder by disguising the traffic in other ways. And the Meek one does it in quite a clever way. You can send it to one of the big cloud hosting providers, so Google or Amazon, for example, and you can point it directly at their server. So you can send it to, say, YouTube.com. That's one of Google's servers. And there's a flag that you can set in your HTTP header that says, actually, forward it on to this server using your cloud hosting. And because your connection between your computer and Google is encrypted, that can't be intercepted. So to anyone spying on the traffic, it appears you're just sending data to Google.
That is interesting.
Assuming Google's not in the country you're in, so the government you're trying to hide from can't go and hit Google with a stick and force them to reveal all their data, then actually this is a way round the side of it.
Right.
There is presumably still traffic fingerprinting they can do, but it's because, for example, the browsing over Tor is going to look very different in terms of packet flows to, say, searching on Google or watching YouTube videos. But that's a much harder thing to do. You can't do that uniformly across hundreds of millions of people unless you've got ridiculously high computer services at your disposal. And if you want to block it, of course you can block it, but that means you have to block the whole of Google and all of Google's services. So it's making this cost of blocking much higher than just saying, oh, we're just going to cut off anything to a known Tor IP address.
Do you know if the servers of Google, Google allows this kind of thing? Is it something they're happy with?
I haven't heard a statement from Google, but they certainly weren't blocking it initially. We'll see. Google obviously has a complicated relationship with the Chinese government. They pulled out a few years ago.
So this directly helps people in China get around the firewall?
Yeah, I mean, that is the main one, because there is what they call the bridges, which are non-published routes.
A bit like private Tor exit relays.
No, private Tor entry nodes.
Oh, okay.
So you can connect them, but they're not on the big list of entry nodes that the government can just block off. However, the Chinese government, I believe, and only the Chinese government, have enumerated all the Tor bridges. So from somewhere like Iran, you should still be able to get in through the bridges, I believe, but not from China. Except I think there's like a couple of guys who hand out bridges that aren't published anywhere else.
It sounds like a William Gibson novel. It's like the future is now.
There's, if you're interested in this, there's some really interesting talks by a guy called Jacob Applebaum. You'll see them on YouTube. And he's a really good speaker, and he's one of the developers who really knows his stuff. He's in Citizen 4, actually, as well.
Oh, I'd love to see that. I mean, it's just out all next week, isn't it, sometime?
Well, I don't know if it's actually got a distributor in the UK. Oh, hang on. Oh, my screensaver came on. They did the preview, the premiere screening as part of the British Film Festival, and they streamed that live to cinemas all over the country, and I went to one of them.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it is really good. I'd highly recommend it.
The film about Edward Snowden.
Yeah, it's about surveillance in general, but obviously it does focus very heavily on Edward Snowden, and a lot of the footage is taken in that Hong Kong hotel room while they're doing, not all the leaks, but certainly like a large portion of them.
I would love to try and get a copy legitimately from somewhere.
Yeah.
Using Tor.
Yes. It's quite cool because you see the they have like the little terminal screens that you sort of see in Hollywood, and you see stuff streaming past. Yeah. But that it's a real terminal. It's the Tails terminal, Amnesia at Amnesia, and they're genuine. They shows you doing. So when they do, we're encrypting their stuff instead of just some Hollywood rubbish scrolling up and down. It's actually GPG.
Yeah.
And when they have to download stuff, it's rsync, and it's. I mean, presumably that's just easier than faking it as well. But
Yeah,
Citizen 4, it sounds quite good. It sounds like that book that you reviewed, Ben, but in film format.
I've reviewed a few books. Oh, hang on. Oh, no, there it is. No, my sound had stopped for a minute then, but it's back.
Pulse Audio.
Yeah, I'm running Pulse Audio and ALSA at the moment. I'm a little bit scared. Yeah, because there's a book by Glenn Greenwald called... Oh, I've forgotten what it's called, actually. And there's another book I reviewed called The Snowden Files by a guy working at The Guardian. And it's probably more like the one by the book by Luke Harding, The Snowden Files, than it is by... Oh, No Place to Hide is Glenn Greenwald's book, I think. But they're both excellent books. And if you're interested in such things, well worth reading. But on with the news. Debian has another resolution on System D. This time, they're proposing that nothing at all ever depend on System D, and everything has to work with other init systems as well.
Wow.
Yes, and someone's proposing this was a general resolution to be voted on very close to the next Debian release being frozen. So that has antagonized a lot of people as well. Because this is
huge.
It's huge. And I mean, there's sort of two sides to this. It's like Debian is the universal operating system. You know, it's prided itself on the fact that there's the K3BSD version. A lot of advocates and Debian supporters say that its flexibility across architectures and kernels is what makes it really, really good. Other people have taken a more pragmatical line, saying, well, yeah, but we just need to get something out of the door. We want a really good PC operating system, basically. And Systemd is enormously controversial, and these flame wars are just going to keep going and going. I think at some point they've just got to decide and say, this is what we're going to do.
Well, they did, didn't they? I mean, that was what we reported, you know, a month ago or whatever.
They did. They chose Systemd. A lot of people weren't happy. A lot of people were happy. Yeah. But, you know, it's all like, this is how it's going to go on. And then, it's the whole topic has been brought back up again. And for more arguments. And
it does seem to be, I mean, that link that you sent to us this morning, Mike, it does seem to be such a hugely contentious, emotive issue that so many people, I mean, public debate just doesn't seem to do this any justice. It's people have become personally attached or personally hate System D and what it represents, and there doesn't seem to be any kind of way around it.
Yeah, exactly. I think early on there were more technical discussions about it, but it's just got to the point now. I think people get emotional about it because it is such a big change to the underpinnings of GNU/Linux system. I mean, this is the plumbing of it. And, you know, it in a way, it's sort of pushing Linux away from its traditional Unix foundations. I think that's not necessarily a problem because we still have traditional Unix systems like the BSDs and stuff, but System D obviously solves a lot of problems for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And, I don't, you know, I'm sort of in two camps about it. Some parts of System D I like, some parts I'm a bit unsure about. But interestingly enough, listeners, in early December, Graham and I are going to Berlin to interview Leonard Puttering and talk to him about System D and his other ideas about the Linux ecosystem. So that would be pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. He seems like a really interesting guy. I mean, I'm open-minded about it. I accept that, you know, boot systems are incredibly technical, especially when they have, you know, they try and encroach upon so much else that's part of the operating system. It doesn't have to remain the same that it has been. But, you know, I was cursing Systemd yesterday, in fact, when I was trying to get my computer to boot and join.
What distribution were you using, Graham?
It was Arch. And Arch. the thing that's so annoying is that just to get, you know, where before I would look at the system log and it's just very easy to tail it and see what has been happening, there's this huge long command that I have to copy. And when you can't get anything else running and you're working purely from the command prompt, trying to type in the huge system control command along with up the reference to the service is just a real pain.
Hmm. Can you not use... I had to do this when I was installing Arch and pull stuff out of the system log, and it seemed really easy. It was just journal control. I think it was two flags. I forget actually what they were.
That's right, and you can actually shift G or whatever it happens to be in Vim to the end of that file. That's true. Yeah. But you're right. I got it to work, and I can live with it. But it's still an alien concept.
So basically, Graham, you did an Arch upgrade, and you didn't read the news on the wiki or
what a noob.
This is a long story, but in fact, I was upgrading my system from KDE4 to KDE5 or Plasma Next and the Frameworks 5 or whatever they happen to be called. And in Arch, you can't have KDE4 and KDE5 installed alongside one another. This will actually mostly change in December or January when the KDE team release the next version of the Frameworks. So that a lot of KDE4 apps will work with the KDE4-based libraries whilst running on KDE5. So it's not going to affect a lot of people. It's not the same as the KDE3 to KDE4 transition. But I made the decision to get rid of all of the KDE4 stuff so I can move purely onto 5, and that's what messed up everything, because I removed just so many packages in the process. And you know, Arch managed it, but yeah, I was left with basically nothing more than a command prompt.
Excellent.
No networking, no video, no accelerated video, no sound. Still got no sound.
So that's Systemd.
Yeah, we could go on and on for Systemd. I know. I mean, there's still people posting comments on our Voice of the Masters for Systemd.
Yeah, and some people or person, it's not clear, have proposed forking Debian should Systemd become all pervasive and unmovable. There's a few things that confuse me about that. First of all, since when has spinning off a new distro been referred to as forking? Is Ubuntu a Debian fork?
So I've heard that it's a Debian fork.
Or a Debian...
derivative.
It's a Debian derivative.
Yeah.
So all they're talking about is creating another Debian derivative. But that doesn't sound dramatic enough, apparently.
With a lightweight, snappy LXDE graphical interface.
Don't people always use kind of biblical phraseology when this kind of stuff happens? You know, like what's a religious divide? Oh, I can't think of it right now.
The schism.
A schism, yeah. There's a Debian schism.
So there'll be a Debian in Avignon and a Debian in Rome.
Yeah, that's right. The BSD Debian is in Avignon. The Systemd the Systemd Debian is in Rome.
Oh. Yeah, like you say, Ben, it's not really clear at this stage whether it's just a couple of guys knocking together a web page, or it's actually, you know, a serious group of people who are proposing this. But yeah, I don't know. Is that what we really need right now?
Especially as far as I'm aware, and I could be wrong on this, but the major thing sort of stopping more init systems being used in Debian, stopping, you know, Upstart or SysV and it staying there, is simply that there's not people there to do the work to maintain them and make sure the packages still work. Centralizing on one obviously means less testing. It means you just have to make one thing work. So creating another distribution isn't going to solve that problem. If there's not enough people who want to support it without Systemd, with the old init systems, are there enough people to create a whole new distro?
I think that's a good point, and this is what a lot of Systemd proponents are saying. Look, it solves a lot of problems for us. If you don't like it, then everybody get together and write an alternative, you know, that is more Unix-like or more modular or whatever. But yeah, show us the code instead of just the constant argument. Let's have a genuinely useful replacement.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on to something a little happier, perhaps. GOG, or formerly known as Good Old Games, now have over 100 Linux titles. Yay!
Yeah, that's really good. I haven't got enough time to download games that I've already played, but it is really good.
Yeah, it's. I mean, a lot of them aren't native Linux games. They're wine wrappers around Windows games or DOS games.
Which kind of works for GOG anyway, because that's what they do for Windows games. You know, they wrap DOSBox around them or whatever they happen to do, or QEMU.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're not going to buy... Actually, to be honest, I haven't really got any games from GOG ever, I don't think.
I got the Ultima 7, which was one of my favourite games of all time. I got that. And I got the free version of, I think it was Dungeon Keeper. There was an Electronic Arts created the Travesty, which was the pay-to-play iPad Android version of Dungeon Keeper, where you basically had to spend real money to speed up the digging part, which is terrible.
Oh.
Another milestone passed for another project. Ubuntu has turned 10.
Fantastic. I was going to mention this with when we were talking about Debian. You know, we take it for granted that Ubuntu just carries on, you know, without really this huge kind of schism. You know, it's one of the good things about having a company behind such a big distribution.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like 10 years to me.
Nothing ever does seem like 10 years.
No.
It just makes me feel old.
We should also probably mention that when this podcast goes online, Ubuntu 14.10 should actually be out. Released.
What, tomorrow?
Ooh. Yes.
Oh, it's due out.
Yeah,
excellent.
Thursday is the release day. Yeah. So. Yeah.
I didn't realise it was so soon.
Yeah, from what I've seen, 14.10 doesn't look like a massive revolutionary release. I mean, it won't have systemd by default, I think, so right. That should keep a few flame wars at bay for a while. I think that's going to come with the release after that.
How about Mir?
No, still not Mir. I'm trying to remember what Thomas Voss said in our interview that we put online recently.
Yeah.
I think he was talking about next year, wasn't he?
He was.
Late next year, at least.
It does have Mir as an option, though, doesn't it?
Maybe in the tablet version, or I'm not sure.
I thought you could switch on Mir in Unity 8.
Or maybe you can.
If you wanted to, although I haven't tried it.
We should review it.
Yes, we should. We should compare its boot times to all the other previous versions in a big
like a video.
That should be quite. Just try and get every version of Ubuntu running from all 20, I assume, if they've hit all of them.
Yeah. And, one thing I wanted to do is I think somebody's made a video about this using Windows, but install Ubuntu Warty Warthog, so it's at 4.10 in a VM, and then try and upgrade through all the successive releases. And yeah, somebody did it with Windows, all the way from like Windows 1 to Windows XP or even Vista. And it actually worked, and they managed to keep their desktop wallpaper all the way through, I think. So they ended up with Vista and this really cheesy, basic Windows 1 wallpaper.
I could remember. I bet it was one of those maze wallpapers, you know, like it was probably just a tiny sprite that was repeated a million times.
Yeah. Or something like that, or his title bar colour. He set the title bar to a different colour in Windows 1, and that remained all the way through. I can't remember exactly, but the videos are great.
Was there like some option that you could only set if you did that? And it was like a little way that other people knew he had uploaded, done it all the way through. Some configuration option they removed in later versions.
But of Windows? I don't know.
But anyway, speaking of Microsoft, apparently they now love Linux.
Yeah.
Yeah, speaking at a... actually, I'm not sure where he was speaking, but their CEO has this, exclaimed their love for Linux. I was obviously feeling quite... I don't know what the word is, controversial or grumpy perhaps this morning when I wrote the podcast notes. Is on my in my little bit of paper in front of me, it says what Microsoft actually loves is profit. Cynical, well, I suppose I was feeling.
They're talking about the number of Linux instances on Azure, aren't they? And it's a significant percentage.
Surprise. People like to use Linux running servers.
What's Azure?
It's their cloud hosting thing.
Like Amazon's or Google's.
Oh, right, okay. And you get a choice of whether to run Windows or Linux.
I bet, yeah, I don't even know if you had... I didn't even know if you originally had a choice to run Linux, but, it, yeah, I think the last couple of years you can.
Yeah. Or of course, not just Amazon or Google, but also Bytemark.
Yeah,
we... kindly provide our hosting.
Well, yeah, yeah. Bytemark do a fantastic job.
Yeah, it's this thing they've been popping up in the kernel contributors list for quite a few years now as one of the top 10 contributors because they've been putting in the various support things to run on Azure and other virtualization solutions. I mean, they're not actually going out of their way to support Linux beyond what they actually have to get it running in servers. I mean, if they loved Linux, they would do something more than that. I don't know. Maybe I am just cynical today.
I think Microsoft's always going to only ever do what's in Microsoft's best direct interest.
Yeah, I guess that's true of just about every major company.
Yeah, but Microsoft, I think in particular, lacks a kind of a wider, broader vision for how it can make money and how I think it could be a better company and perhaps more profitable company if it embraced a few of the more Linuxy things.
Can you imagine if Microsoft had launched its own Linux distribution, say 5 or 6 years ago, and made sure that all the hardware was supported and it looked great and it integrated with Windows?
Exactly. Yeah, I think it would have been a huge success.
There wouldn't be any need for Google Chrome, for example.
And why not, really? Well, you know, it's almost like a pride issue with the whole Windows brand, the same with their smartphone strategy. You know, not in the same way that Oracle did with Unbreakable Linux, you know, basically just copying RHEL. But, you know, if actually Microsoft really got behind it. But it's just,
I think we also need to be clear when... Is it Satya Nadella, the CEO, said he loves Linux? Did he say he's a fan of System D or not? That's a great headline there. Yeah. Microsoft backs System D. Just watch the internet.
Or maybe they're doing the divide and rule strategy. They'll support Debian fork.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, they've probably got people trolling the mailing list right now.
Maybe that's it. Maybe it's all been created by Microsoft.
Yeah, it's not.
Actually, all Linux users are fine with System D.
Red Hat is Microsoft.
What?
Leonard Puttering is Steve Ballmer.
They've just planted Leonard Puttering and Thomas Voss. And they're trying to break the Linux community. Oh, and that's the news this fortnight. A nice, short, sprightly news section. It's only lasted half an hour.
It was good news. It was good, considering that was the entire duration of our previous podcast. I got a few messages from people saying the previous one was too short, so I think this one's going to make up for it. Which leads us on to our finds.
Great.
Just before starting up the recording, I mentioned it on the IRC channel that we were going to do this and if anybody had any finds. And I've just switched back and there's 40 messages there.
Wow.
So shall I start with reading out some from the IRC channel?
Yeah.
So which IRC channel is this, for our listeners?
This is Hash Linux Voice on Freenode. Currently there's 49 people in there.
Yeah, everybody should join chat.freenode.net. Point your IRC client at that and join a hash Linux Voice, yeah.
Unlike the rest also of the internet, it's a really friendly place, and you know, there's not an awful lot of traffic, but you know, it's some nice friendly conversation in there.
There's also a link directly on our new website.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh, there is, isn't
We've got
there?
A new website.
Our social media buttons.
Oh, that's good.
Right, so this is good actually. Twisted Lucidity asked me to mention a talk being held at the Nottingham Linux User Group. The talk is by Matt Lee, and he's from the Creative Commons and GNU project. The talk looks really, really interesting. I think Matt's doing a bit of a tour of the UK, but he's talking at the Nottingham Linux User Group on October the 27th, which I think is a week on Thursday. And I'll put a link in the podcast notes. There's a whole agenda for the kind of things that he's going to be talking about. But there's a lot. It's all free software. It's GNU, Creative Commons. I think he's a real advocate of Floss with an emphasis on the GNU. So that genuinely looks like a really good event. Twisted Lucidity also mentions Tmux, which actually comes up time and time again.
Tmux is cool.
Yeah, I mean, it allows you, it's basically like a window manager for your shell. And it's like Screen if you use Screen, but I've not used Tmux because I've got so used to Screen, but we've talked about it a few times.
Well, the main thing, straight out of the box, Tmux gives you a nice little sort of taskbar thing along the bottom so you can see what's running.
Another thing is Waring, he's told me how to pronounce it, it's mobiletest.me, which is a really cool site. In fact, I think he sent me that link when we were just making the new site design live. If I just type it into a browser, I think it's the site that comes up with test. It allows you to test your website rendered in lots of different mobile, smartphone, tablet hardware.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, you go to the site, you click on Google Nexus 7 or iPad Mini, whatever, and then type in the URL of the site you want to test, and the site is rendered within exactly as it would appear on one of those devices, which is incredibly useful. Just skipping through all these, it's difficult to read. PG Woodhouse. It looks like they're the main discoveries, the main finds from the IRC channel. I should have libferris is an interesting find. I'll put those links in the podcast notes. So thanks to the channel. I'm switching back to the right desktop so I can see you all again.
Hey.
Ciao.
How about you guys? Have you got anything?
Yes. It's the Humble Mozilla Bundle.
Yes. Yeah.
You can probably work this out from the name alone. but I'd really forgotten about the Humble Bundles because they, back in ye olden times, it was a big deal. It felt like a big deal. But then they started to come really thick and fast. And sometimes they didn't all have, all the games weren't Linux compatible, which was a bit annoying. So I just started to ignore them. But you can get a big bunch of games just to play in your browser, in Firefox.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic.
I noticed this in Firefox because the landing page was like a playable demo of Voxatron.
Yeah.
Really
was it playable?
It was playable.
Yeah. W-A-S-A-D. Oh,
I didn't even notice it was playable. I just saw it and thought, oh, that looks quite cool. And then typed in what I wanted to search for.
No. But as with as is traditional with Linux users being better people than anybody else, it's often reported as free, the Humble Bundle, but it's not. It's pay what you want, and one of those options can be nothing. So the average purchase price for the bundle is $5.66, which is worth it for Osmos alone because Osmos is fantastic. The average Windows purchase price, £5, $5.27. Average Mac, $7.28. Average Linux purchase, $8.
Yes.
So, you know, just what we've known all along, there is a market for games. Linux people like to... I think, actually, it comes back to the whole freedom isn't free. Because we get so much stuff for free, we know the value of software. We know that there is a real value attached to good quality stuff that you can download, rather than just, you know, I've been forced to pay for this piece of rubbish, so I'm going to extract karma from the internet by leeching as much as possible.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I still buy applications, but the applications that I buy are carefully picked, and I make sure that I get my value from them. Yeah. Anyone else?
I've got a few discoveries, actually. The first one, I went a bit crazy, and I splashed out on some high-tech virtual reality hardware that is, in fact, folded cardboard. I have it here that you guys can see, but the readers can't.
The readers can't see this, nor can the listeners.
Nor can the listeners. The readers will be able to see it. I'll put a photo in the magazine. It's Google's cardboard, which is basically, they have these plans online for that you can cut out of cardboard and stick together. You need a couple of lenses, a magnet, and an NFC tag. I still haven't worked out what the NFC tag actually does. But anyway.
I think it just automates it. It just activates it automatically or something, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know, actually. Maybe.
What's the magnet for?
The magnet doesn't work on my phone, but if you've got a Nexus 5, by clicking the magnet, it's got a magnet and I assume a bit of metal on one side, so the magnet sort of sticks to it. And it's in a slight channel, so if you pull it down and let it go, it pops back up. And apparently, if you've got a Nexus 5, that's enough to trigger the magnetic sensor in it.
Oh, so, okay.
And it uses that as like an input, but it doesn't work on my phone. So I have to poke my finger through the nose hole and tap the screen. Apparently, it works if you put a bit of tinfoil touching the screen leading out to the side and touch the tinfoil, that registers as a touch on the screen.
Ooh.
Although I haven't actually tried that yet, so I don't know.
So where did you get it from? And where did you get the lenses from?
I got it all as a kit from Amazon.
Right.
And you can get various bits. You can get just the lenses. I mean, if you just search for Google Cardboard, 100 options will come up.
How much is it?
They vary. I think if you get the little bits, it comes in as like about a fiver.
Right, oh, okay.
And if you get the full thing all ready to go, it's about, I don't know, 10 or 15 quid, I think.
Excellent.
So, and I think you've got to sort of keep your expectations in match with what it is. It's folded cardboard, let's be honest.
Well, I tried the app on my Nexus 5, you know, without any of the lenses, because I'm pretty good at crossing my eyes over, you know. And by holding the phone about a foot away from my eyes, I was able to get a sense of it. So I don't think I would be disappointed with the cardboard version.
Because I've read these things and people are like, oh, I expected an equivalent to hundreds of pounds of Oculus Rift for £3 worth of folded cardboard. It's not that, but it is. If you accept it for what it is a brilliant bit of kit. It's fun. It's surprisingly good 3D. It's obviously going to depend on the resolution of your phone, because essentially you're cutting the resolution in half and giving a separate image to each eye and magnifying it, so it is much more pixelated than it would be normally. But it's still sort of, it's not bad. And it's fantastic for it. It's got, if your phone's got a gyro in it, it can do head tracking, which on the phones I've tried has been all right. It hasn't been great because it hasn't been able to update the screen quite quick enough, so there's been a slight jitter, which has been a bit annoying.
Yeah, that can make people feel a bit nauseous, can't it? And
to be honest, I can feel a bit nauseous just watching 3D films in it, so I'm the wrong person to ask about that. I've discovered that it's a great fun. It's also, it's kind of like how I want 3D to arrive. It's an open thing. You can hack, you can poke about, you can program for it. It's not some closed off thing with some, you know, walled garden of software that you have to jailbreak your phone to be able to use or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's folded cardboard that you make in your cupboard and then write your own programs for. That is how I want 3D
virtual reality
to be.
I'm gonna get one.
Yeah, I'm thinking about one now.
What kind of software do you run on it? I mean, so I tried the app, which kind of embedded things like Google Earth and stuff like that.
Yeah, the app's the best demonstration stuff. People have been creating games. we actually only got the internet here yesterday, so I haven't been able to download that much stuff. There's also a load of video. You can just use YouTube, like normal YouTube player, and there's 3D videos. Obviously, you don't get head tracking or anything like that. It's just watching a 3D video. And the thing you need to search for that is SBS, side by side.
Right.
Search for SBS 3D. There's loads of videos. Most of them are quite short. There's one, I don't think it's actual footage, but of Felix.
The big jumping from space, big
skydive. Yeah, and that's quite cool. There's some of roller coasters and whatnot.
That's really cool.
Yeah. It's still early days. There's not that much software for it yet. But given the rate they've been selling, I'd expect there to be quite a bit more software shortly. From what I've heard, a lot of places did sell out initially.
Yeah, I'd heard the lenses were really difficult to come by.
Yeah, I don't know. Mine were, I got them quite easily, but I got them, I think, a couple of days after it was announced, and I think they're harder to get hold of.
Right.
More discoveries. Actually, I've had quite a few discoveries. I've been pushing the envelope a bit this
I'll just go and get my lunch.
Yes. I installed Arch, which is quite a dangerous thing to do. But I thought I'd go for it, as we did rate it the best Linux distro.
Documentation's great, I've heard.
Well, my first thing was the discovery, or the find even, was that the documentation isn't as great as it, some people seem to claim it is. Ooh. Now, there were some... I don't know, I sort of rushed the install a bit, so I didn't perhaps read
the
it
beginner's
as well
guide's
as
excellent.
Well, it is, if you've got an Ethernet connection. It completely misses the thing that you need to do if you don't have an Ethernet connection, you're relying on a wired connection.
There's a huge article on wireless connectivity.
Yeah, and it all seems to based on the assumption that you already have an Ethernet connection. Because it's like, to set up wireless connection, download this.
That's true, yeah. Yeah.
There's a problem with that assumption. but anyway, I did eventually manage to get it working. There's something weird going on with my fonts. The only way I could make Twitter not hurt my eyes was by manually deleting Helvetica. but I probably did something wrong there. That's probably my fault, not Archer's. Still don't have any icons on my login screen either. I can't work out what's going on there.
What login manager is it?
LDM. I just picked one out of a hat, really. I'm using the Mate desktop, which I'm quite liking.
Now we know how to pronounce it.
Yes. overall, I've been quite impressed. The repositories are good. It's a bit more faff installing stuff than I thought it would be from the Arch user repositories.
I was just going to say, one of the things I discovered this week is Aura, which is a package front end for Arch that combines both the AUR repository and the official and extras. And what's really nice about it is that with AUR packages, it's really difficult to update all the ones that you have installed or to include it in the pacman-syu. But Aura does all of that for you, and you can, and it's also got some extra commands for reverting packages. And there's still all the stuff you can do with Pacman, but it basically makes updating your system as simple as a single command, no matter where they came from.
Because I'm using, I don't even know how you pronounce this, Yort.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty much the standard AUR package manager.
My only beef with that is that it's not very automated.
No.
So I tend, when you're downloading stuff, you just leave it installing, then you go and make a cup of tea, come back, and you use the software.
Yeah.
What's this? You have to keep pressing stuff.
I can't remember exactly what the options are, but there's a configuration file where you can turn off all the confirmation messages to put them to no or whatever. So you can get it to not keep asking you all those questions about, do you want to edit the make file?
But I guess I fundamentally have a pretty similar system I could have got with different distros, but I think the thing is, once it did make me think about what I wanted on my system, and I think because of that, I do have a slightly different setup than I would have otherwise. And one thing, actually, another my I'll limit my finds this fortnight to three because I'm rambling on far too much. But my final find, and I only got this because I was sort of, I was trying to find the best system for me, was Terminator. It's a terminal emulator. And it might be a little bit like TMUX. Again, I've always used Scream, but it allows you to, you got multiple, what's the word, sort of panes on your window. So you can have a full screen window with like four or five different panes on it and shuffle between them, and you can send the same command to more than one of them. If you're managing multiple servers, doing upgrades and that sort of thing. I recommend that as well. But
does it just make it easier to use than Screen, is it?
Yeah, I've always found Screen a little bit fiddly. Not too bad, but Terminator is, as yeah, it's just worked.
Yeah,
a bit better for me.
Cool.
And those are my finds.
Thanks, Ben. You got anything, Mike?
I do. Yeah. As we discussed before, Ubuntu is 10 years old, and some people,
which is
might,
awesome. Thanks to the Ubuntu people, it's a fantastic distribution. I really firmly believe it's changed the whole Linux distribution landscape for the better. So it's brilliant.
Well, I still use Zubuntu. XFCE is my main go-to distro. But yeah, some people will know the history behind Ubuntu. But basically, Mark Shuttleworth in 2003 or 2004 went on a holiday to Antarctica and took an archive of the Debian mailing list with him as reading material, as you do, and came up with this plan that he wanted to make a Debian-based distro that's more commercial and more up-to-date and stuff. So he sent out this following email to a bunch of like senior Debian developers. I'm going to read out the email now. It's just short, but, "Dear friend, how are you and your family hope fine? I am Mark Shuttleworth from the great country of South Africa. Due to good fortune mine in business, I have come into money of the sum $575 million. I would like to with you discuss business opportunity and solicit your confidentiality in this transaction. Pleased to discuss by phone at your earliest convenience." So,
excellent.
A lot of people deleted this message. Yeah. People who couldn't
Is that real?
Sorry? It's real. Yeah, that's real. That's the email. It is.
That can't be real.
It is. A lot of Debian developers chucked it away, apparently. But one of the earliest Ubuntu Canonical employees said that, yeah, he found this strange, so he actually did phone up Mark Shuttleworth.
I remember speaking to Jeff Waugh about exactly this, and he got the email.
I think it is real.
I think it was only because a friend of Jeff's had said, yeah, it's real, or that, yeah, Mark's serious, or Mark is this person, that it was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, just a couple of facts as well. Canonical was originally called MRS Virtual Development for Mark Richard Shuttleworth, and the original name of the distro, well, the working code name, was Warty Warthog before they settled on Ubuntu.
So
obviously Warty Warthog became the code name for the actual first release, but yeah, because the...
We should mention the new one, shouldn't we? The new code name.
What's it called? Vapid... Velociraptor...
Is something Vervis.
Seamless Googling.
I thought that was the code name, the Seamless Salamander. Like, we've already been through S.
It's still the Vivid Vervet.
The
1504, 1504 is a kind of monkey, is it?
Yeah, vervet monkey.
Yeah.
I'm still upset they didn't go with Manky Monkey.
Well, they will cycle through at some point, Andrew, so maybe in like 2060 you'll get your Manky Monkey.
Thanks, Mike. You're giving me something to live for.
And that's my find.
I haven't had that much time for finds, other than rebuilding Arch and getting it to work again. I'd like to mention that the SPAN conference, which we're kind of helping to sponsor a little bit, it is actually on Tuesday, the 28th, in London, which is like a big data conference. And it looks really interesting. I may try and get along. It depends on what other things are going on. And then the other interesting thing that's well out of my price range... is a Kickstarter called the G-Pack, which is like this high-end gaming PC that hides behind your screen. It looks incredibly well engineered. It looks like one of those old rack servers that you'd slot into, you know, into something. But what happens is that the Kickstarter, I don't know if it's going to be successful actually, because it's only got 10 days to go and it's got lots of, it needs a lot of money. But it's a really interesting idea in that you put a PC, a huge PC, behind your LCD screen. And in fact,
isn't that what the iMac did? Basically?
Yeah, but this is—it's the size of a—it's the size of one of those old rack servers, you know, so that they can fit in a high-end GPU and proper cooling and a decent motherboard and the latest stuff. And I think it ends up—if you just want the rack—it's like $500 or $600, and it's designed for SteamOS. There's a link. They're going to be selling these things for $2,000 with booting directly to SteamOS. Okay. Which they say it's really quiet and they say it's a powerful games PC. If I had the money, I'd be interested in one, but then you can get a very cheap shuttle case for $50 and go your own route.
I was just thinking, Graham, are you starting to be in the market for some high-end PC hardware in anticipation of Elite Dangerous now?
Oh, well, that would be awesome. I hope that my i5, I've got a couple of years old GPU, would be able to handle it, but the worst thing would be putting Windows on it.
Yeah, that's true.
So they're my discoveries, and they are discoveries. Finds. That we must be due a halfway reminder now, Andrew.
We are. It's after almost an hour, it's time for the halfway reminder. Still to come, there's a couple of neurons to vocalise, and there's Voice of the Masses. If you...
And I guess... What? Because, I was just going to say, because Voice of the Masses, everybody seems to be in agreement. That should be quite quick this time.
It should be, yeah. That's really it, to be honest, for this halfway reminder.
Good work, Andrew. That's one of the better halfway reminders I've heard. I'd say it's definitely in the top 50% in my collection of halfway reminders. So
it's above halfway.
About halfway. 50% I'd rate it. Right, so a couple of neurons have been sent in for me to vocalise. Tom Griggs says, I am a bit of a distro hopper, although this is limited to Debian-based distros as it helps me with the knowledge that I've acquired over the years. I frequently go between Cinnamon and KDE desktops. I like Cinnamon for its simplicity and stability, KDE for its customization options, and powerful native apps such as Dolphin and Amarok. I'm planning to create a separate home partition on its own drive when installing to enable me to install both Cinnamon and KDE distros. To someone that does not feel the need to know how the more complicated nuts and bolts of Linux works, how future-proof is this? Can I realistically keep the home partition isolated like that and merrily hop from distro to distro if they appeal to me? Or does whatever Linux have in the pipeline make this not a good idea? It's an interesting question. Does anybody else do this, keep the same home partition across different distros?
I have done.
No, I keep a separate partition, which I have stuff like my... Ooh.
Sorry, Ben, it just cut out.
I think you got out of sync, Graham.
Right. I have a separate partition which I use for things like downloads, and you can actually point Firefox to a particular folder, so I have all my Firefoxes pointed to the same downloads folder, and the same for VirtualBox and Steam, all in a separate thing, but I have the same home folders, because I want different settings and stuff in different distros.
Yeah, it's not something that I've done. I usually just tend to reinstall distros complete from scratch and just copy a few settings over that I need. So, any listeners who do use a home partition regularly across multiple distros, please let us know in the comments how it works for you or what some of the potential pitfalls are. Next, Neuron is from Nathaniel Olander. He says, I've been listening to the Linux Voice podcast since the beginning of season 2 and thoroughly enjoy it. I listen to it when I'm at my job and love the whole thing, especially the finds of the fortnight. However, one thing I'm increasingly peeved about is the incredible lack of Linux, FOSS and Raspberry Pi conventions in the USA, like the ones
I thought he was going to say in the podcast then.
Like the ones mentioned in season 2 episode 17, Ogcamp seems to come up a lot. Yeah, sure, we have OSCON and the occasional Maker Faire, but beyond that, there's hardly anything that's easily findable. I love the whole idea of Ogcamp and the Raspberry Jams, but there's simply nothing like them that I know of over here. So yeah, that's my neuron to vocalise. Keep up the good work. Keep calm and Linux on. Thanks for that. Yeah, I don't know if but stateside Raspberry Jams, have you heard much about these, Ben?
We've mentioned this before, I think. Maybe when we met a couple of people at Ogcamp from the States, and they said, you know, there's really nothing like this in the States.
I think there's a real issue of discoverability here, because I keep finding out about stuff near me just after it's happened. You sort of go into Twitter on a Monday morning, and it's like, oh, I had a great time at blah, blah, blah. I was like, oh, that was just around the corner. I could have gone to that. I think Raspberry Pi have got their new jams, I don't know what it is, website where they've got the map of them all and the calendar so you can see what's coming up. And there's certainly, the majority of them are in the UK, but there are some in the States.
Yeah.
And there do seem to be a lot of things like mini maker fairs and...
I mean, there's nowhere, no single place where all this information is available. I mean, I'm reluctant to say that we could do something because we can't actually spare the time to put any work into it. But I mean, if somebody out there wanted to kind of put this kind of list together, we could certainly host it and give it advertising and give it some publicity.
Yeah, I mean, all it would really need is a wiki page that people could come and add their stuff to.
Yeah, because we do get a lot of people getting in touch asking, you know, for publicity for, you know, what all great events, but I think we've just kind of maxed ourselves out on the jobs that we're doing at the moment. Yeah, maybe we should do that wiki page.
I found out about a Raspberry Jam near me 2 weeks before it's going to happen.
Wow.
Yeah, I know, amazing. That's Huddersfield, and that's going to be this Saturday.
Excellent. So, yeah, those are the neurons. If anybody else wants their beautifully crafted words read out in the voice of John Lennon, just email mike at linuxvoice.com.
I know you've said it before, but it's still funny. All right, well, I think that leads us on to Voice of the Masses there, doesn't it, Andrew?
That's right, Ringo. yes, so forking, is there too much forking? This is prompted by the Debian system D thing. Yeah, obviously we need software projects to fork, and when things become stagnant, then it's great that, for example, Mageia can just go off and, although as we've discussed, distros don't really fork, they become derivatives. But LibreOffice is the best example. A lot of the developers didn't like the way that OpenOffice.org was going, so they just set up camp and on their own and created something bigger and better. But it can go too far, or can it? This is what we wanted to know from you. And the consensus is that no, there can't be too much thing as too much forking. Too much thing as too much forking? I'm so sorry. There's no such thing as too much forking. Forking is good and healthy. And here are a few people...
What? Just my dirty mind.
Stop sniggering at the back, Morrison.
Forking is good and healthy.
Well, xiaoj, on that note, I don't think there can be too much forking if you excuse the possible double entendre. If a project gets forked. Oh no, I'm thinking it now as well. right. Everybody agrees, of the 17 comments that were there this morning, everybody agrees there's no such thing as too much forking. But within that, there is a subset of comments that bring a new insight. So Kader says, the problems people associate with forking are normally the result of developers not getting along or other technical issues like incompatible licenses. The best forks are the ones who take over dead projects or breathe life into existing ones.
And further down the document, Phil Fane says, It works. OpenOffice, that's forking. OpenOffice was stuck in a rut. LibreOffice works better and has proved popular with most Linux distros. OpenOffice now has a different interface derived from IBM Symfony and can, if its devs choose, import improved code from LibreOffice. It is confusing to people using FOSS on non-free OS who aren't used to this sort of behaviour, but they'll get over it. Lucifer says, forking Debian, is that Ubuntu, isn't it? Smiley face. And Stuart Ward says, moderation in all things. Is the level of forking in FOSS too much, about right, or too little? My gut feel is that it's about right. We fork only when absolutely necessary, because the cost of a fork of a big project is enormous. Change the name, rebuild a community, build environment, website, wiki, mailing lists, and endless hours justifying what you've done for years afterwards.
Yeah,
that's something that I've never thought of, but yeah, it makes perfect sense now.
Yeah, I mean, even when we spoke to Florian, Mike, you know, he was still saying that they're still, you know, they're still racing to catch up with the power of the OpenOffice brand, effectively.
Mm. Yep. And Rakios, hello, says, you can never have too much of the right sort of forking, i.e. that which leads to something better. The problem is the other sort, which just leads to division of effort and a number of poor quality pieces of software, rather than a couple of really good ones that represent useful choice. And the last words, I reckon, to Kevin O'Brien, who says, forking is bad when it is other people doing something you don't agree with. For instance, clearly Linux Mint creating the Cinnamon desktop was an evil fork of Ubuntu and should have been stopped. And if you can show me a majority who agree with that, I think that there is too much forking. Yes.
I don't think there's too much forking. I think the threat of forking happening is a really powerful incentive to try and keep communities and projects together. And I suppose that has to happen, and it has to happen sometimes for the good and sometimes for the bad, for people to kind of have the right impression of whether it's worthwhile or not, or whether the effort's worthwhile or not. But I think the threat of having the right to make a fork is a really good incentive to try and be as inclusive and try and be as progressive as possible. You know, there have been just a few times where it's been so vital. I mean, with X386 and with LibreOffice, that, you know, I don't think we can say that it's ever been too much, because, you know, it helped so much, even though there are a million different versions of macOS written by 10-year-olds.
Yeah, I must have a record. There's been over 20 forks of macOS now, and they, apart from one, which was actually good, the rest of them just die in like 2 weeks when people realize they can't make it 128-bit and run every Windows and OS X program.
And they all cause disruption and noise and added effort, don't they? For you and the macOS community. And
why is
that's not a good thing.
Why is Mike's managerial leadership style so bad that 20 people have tried to fork his project? Shouldn't you just be trying to build a more cohesive community? Shouldn't you read The Art of Community by John O'Bacon?
Unfortunately, I've been taking the Linus Torvalds approach and just flaming everybody on my mailing list all the time.
What's the one good fork of macOS?
The one good fork was called Tachyon OS, and it's actually a guy who went and added loads of features that I said I didn't want to necessarily add because I wanted... I can't remember.
Oh, name, I thought it might be Tachyon, that's all.
Wasn't there a Tom OS as well?
There was, actually, that died, but that was similar in that they actually added useful stuff like a mouse driver and things beyond the scope of a learning operating system, I thought. But yeah, they're actually really good, instead of just changing the background colour and then going and plastering some rubbish all over SourceForge and saying it's going to take over Windows and I've spoken to Steve Jobs about you and all the other nonsense. I'm not bitter.
Well, it was a bit silly of me to say so. I'm sorry, Mike, but the possibility that a project can fork, that if you're a manager, you can't just say, you know, do it this way because I say so. There has to be consensus. And that the possibility then that people can disagree and just go off and do their own thing leads to a much more, you know, consensus-based model of development. You know, you'd never get a project... You never get a Linux distribution just turning out, you know, the equivalent of Windows 8 with its Metro tile-based interface because somebody within the project would say halfway through, hang on, this isn't the right thing to do, and they'd go off and create Cinnamon or Mate.
Yeah, I think a lot of the sort of forks and or like distro derivatives are the small ones are because people just want to have a their own pet projects, you know, to play with. There was one point when there was like 15 different Ubuntu spin-offs with LXDE as the default desktop, all doing it almost exactly the same thing. Those weren't particularly, they didn't contribute a lot back, but yeah, people should still have the right to do it.
And I think another thing that's often sort of overlooked is sometimes there are genuinely two good directions software can go in. Mm-hmm. Like you said, with the Tachyon spin-off of MicroS, there was a good reason for you not wanting to include that in MicroS. Yeah, there was also a good reason for there to be another project that did have it.
Yeah, I really, really encouraged this, which I thought some people on the mailing list thought was a bit odd, but I said, please go and fork it. You know, this is a useful fork, not just because you want to put your own name on an operating system, but this is actually good. I wanted it to be way more successful than MicroS. I wanted that to be the future of the code, because I'm not really doing much now.
Right, Mike's not really doing much now. That seems like a good place to end it.
I actually have one more thing.
Oh, excellent.
And it's that we're trying to pull together an audio recording of issue 1 of Linux Voice, which is soon to be released under the Creative Commons license. And we thought that making an audio recording of some of the articles, the ones that work best when spoken, would be a good way of making content as accessible as possible. So we're trying to kind of crowdfund the recording of all of this because it's a lot of effort. We've done a few pages ourselves, but we've also got people like Mark Johnson and Stuart Langridge recording some. And if you want to get involved, if you've got a microphone and a copy of Audacity, if you haven't got a copy of an issue one, just email me and I'll let you know. Get involved and help us pull it together. And also for further issues, if this is a success, we'll carry on doing it. So check out the new redesigned website and the story on there. I'll put the link in the podcast notes. And it only takes about half an hour to do a feature, which would really help. That's it. So that's the end of the podcast.
Thanks for listening.
see you all again in 2 weeks.
Hooray.
Thanks. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.